why is it as bad as it is? Why is it not worse? It's as bad as it is because there's nowhere safe nearby for these guys to flee to. There is no, despite contemporary accounts, there is no nearby bog. And there are hedgerows, so if you can imagine, you're trying to clamber away from pursuing the cavalry. What is your problem going to be? Trying to climb up, can you imagine maybe hundreds of men trying to get over the same ditch, the same at the same time, and cavalrymen attacking them? So, you know, the horse can jump over, and these anti-infantrymen can, and they can pursue. The advantage, or if you like, what saves the Irish is that the fact that it's getting dark. After dark, it's not safe for horse to be pursuing at speed, because they'll stumble and take a fall. So that saves, that's, if you like, keeps the losses less than they would otherwise be, but it's still a serious problem.
Was this really the bloodiest battle in Ireland that it's reputed to be?
It's hard to say. Yes, it is, because if you take it on the Williamite side, if you take this, say, 3,000 killed, leaving aside prisoners, on the Jacobite side, there's up to 1,000 killed on the Williamite side, so it's 4,000 men killed, which probably puts it, not by a long shot, but it puts it out there as the bloodiest battle in modern Irish history. There are others in the 17th century that are relative to the size of the arms involved, dwarfs. Scarif Hollis in 1650, maybe up to 3,000. Dunmanteil in 1647, again about 3,000 on the Irish, on each case on the Irish side. Relative to the size of the armies involved, Ockham is not as bad as that, but in absolute terms, there are more people killed there.
Those battles are a lot more one-sided as well, don't they?
Exactly. They're catastrophically one-sided, whereas Ockham was by no means one-sided. The Williamites were getting rather the worst of it all day, and then it turned suddenly.
Yeah, the Battle of Ockham on the day was pretty bad, let's say, for the Jacobites, but it was also more or less the battle that ended the war. Why was that?
Think about what the Irish are fighting for, right? At the year, their first year, one of the war, they're probably fighting like their King James, seeing Ireland as a stepping stone whereby he can get Scotland and England and reinstall himself as king. By 1690, they're not thinking of that. They're thinking, let's try and defend Dublin. The Boyne is fought to defend Dublin, and they're thinking it's a high Merlo-centric war at that stage. After Dublin, what are they fighting for? After the loss of the Boyne, after the loss of most of Leinster and Cork, they're fighting, many of them, to get the best terms they can. They don't see themselves winning in the sense that they're going to drive the enemy out of Ireland again. But by God, they're going to make it so difficult for them that they will offer them satisfactory terms, whereby they can have some religious guarantees, they can keep their land, they're not going to be subjected to a punitive peace. It would be the view of people like of the Viceroy, like Richard Talbot, none of the Earl Tyrconnell. Minority view would be that of the Viceroy's Patrick Sarsfield and his cabal, who would be bitterly anti-Talbot. And they're do or die. They want to fight on and fight on. They're not interested in a compromise peace. And the French, who are the paymasters, they are of the view that Ireland is a very good diversion, and if it keeps the Allies tied down, a larger Allied army tied down in Ireland, they won't be in the real theatre of the Spanish Netherlands. So that's all to the good. So therefore, they have a vested interest in a protracted war. The Irish don't necessarily, most of them, want a protracted war. They want a war whereby they'll get good terms. Ockham means what? Ockham means that after Ockham, the Irish are much more amenable to accepting terms than they would have been heretofore. That's what the Treaty of Limerick and the Retreat to Limerick is about. The Irish, including Sarsfield at this stage, I mean, Sarsfield, once Talbot dies, takes over as de facto leader, and as Limerick, they capitulate, they agree to disband and cease fighting in return for certain guarantees about property and about religious freedom. Guarantees certainly in the case of religious freedom, to have this, which are vaguely expressed in the capitulation or the so-called Treaty of Limerick and are breached. But those are the stakes at this point in the war. What change does Ockham make? Ockham means that the Irish are much more amenable to talking about peace and to capitulating than they would have been heretofore.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Treaty of Limerick and all the aftermath that entails is very important from the point of view of consolidating the Protestant control over Ireland.
Absolutely. And the Treaty of Limerick is that capitulation. And from the point of view of the Protestant community in Ireland is a shameful one because it's a compromise. It's not utter an unconditional defeat for the Irish. They're in a position still to bargain. And they're probably as well that they did bargain when they did. Because had the war lasted, and this is the paradox, suppose he did win at Aughrim, what was going to happen? What would happen if Sanroot hadn't been shot? If he had phoned back the Williamites, he would have been hard put to inflict the decisive defeat on the Williamites for the same reason they were having it hard. He'd have to cross the bog to get at the others. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So the most he would have done was push them back as far as Athlone, which they controlled. The strategic prize, the crossing of the Shannon River, would not have been changed. You might have protracted the war from into 1692. By which stage, the French, if you look at the bigger picture, the French had quite exceptionally control of the sea lanes, sea dominance, from, say, 1690, 1891. They would lose that in 1692. Mm. Not only that, but by 1694, they're facing into serious famine. Not just financial crisis, famine.
In France,
so that the capacity of the French to sustain a war in Ireland would not have lasted much longer than it did. So that the Irish, when they did capitulate, did so, nobody was to know that this would happen, that the French position would weaken. The Irish, when they did capitulate, did so at a time when they still mounted a credible threat.
Mm-hmm.
They were in a relatively good bargaining position.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've talked about the military and the political significance of the Battle of Aughrim. What about the cultural significance? Let's start off, first of all, with the Irish language tradition. I mean, there's a pretty rich vein of poetry, I think, about the Battle of Aughrim. Is that right?
Yes. It brings up a theme that's echoed further on. And it's the loss, this idea of slaughter, Aughrim and Aughrim, or Aughrim of the slaughter. And my favourite poem is by a man named Seamus Dáil MacCúrta. He'd be an Oriel poet. Oriel is what we now think of as Loud, Monaghan, South Armagh, and in Aughrim and Aughrim, Tóid gan Cónaí, Taisin na Gnámh, or Lár gan Córa. These are, he describes the bones scattered around Aughrim's daughter, so many princes, who now lie gan Leacha, gan Fearta, gan Tórav, without headstone, grave, or wake. Tórav is awake. Because he's lamenting the higher-ups, the officers who were killed. Or if you take the popular poetry, you've got a monster poet of a more, if you like, plebeian ranker sympathies. He talks about the soldiers, Taliasa, Egekalis, Naganyev, Nafiluk, Oxidri, Tapa, Genogaska, Lepiga, Augie, Eden, Akram, and the Strahan, the Shinta, Marveak, Fior, Koppel, Egmondri, the Ostrila, Argostrila, O'Kelly, O'Kelly is the is associated with the O'Kelly country. So O'Kelly has Lassa or fertilizer, and it's not limestone or it's not manure, but so soldiers, lively soldiers who'd been doing Gashka or a great deeds with the pike, and now where are they? They're left Augusheed and Aughrim in the Strahan, they're stretched in rows at Aughrim, and they've been eaten like horse meat by dogs.
Yeah, I mean, No, I mean, you know, it reminds me a little bit of things like, you know, the Boys of Kilmichael, which are more modern kind of popular evocations of, you know, the young lads who went out to fight. And it's really very sad when you think about, you know, Kilmichael or something like that, you've got one or two killed. At Aughrim, you would have had thousands and thousands.
Thousands. I mean, you get this, and you get the same team translating into, if you take a contemporaneous couple of decades later, County Westmeath poet, Lawrence from White, again, Catholic, is writing in English this time. And he mourns, you know, most of those who fell in Aughrim's fatal plain, manured with blood of thousands slain. So that's, if you like, Irish language tradition goes into the English tradition. Mm-hmm. And it, in a sense, distorts the fact that it wasn't that big. And obviously it matters a lot if you're one of the 3,000 that are killed.
Mm.
But 3,000 is not as enormous a scale of catastrophe as was thought to be. Why is Aughrim perceived in popular memory to be so catastrophic? And it was. And the reason isn't so much the number of people, the sheer number of people who are killed, but who's killed. It disproportionately affects the leadership elite of the Catholic community. And that matters, because this is not a democratic society. It's a very hierarchical society. Leadership, political, cultural, military comes from the top down. and if you were, if you can decapitate, as it were, a society, they're much more weakened. And what happens in Aughrim disproportionately affects the land, the surviving Catholic landowners, and this is their last effort, their last gasp. If you look at the casualty statistics, I talked about maybe one in every four infantry soldiers killed, but if you look at the go up the ranks and take, for example, the colonels of regiments, there's something like, there's 32 regiments, so there are 32 regimental Jacobite colonels present at the battle. Of those 32, 17 are killed, mortally wounded, or taken prisoner. Now, why does that matter? Moving on, if you're killed in action during the war, taken prisoner, or wounded, not only are you lost, but your lands are lost. The protections of the Treaty of Limerick and the Articles of Galway, they only apply if you're still alive to claim them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't cover people who've died, have been killed, died, or taken prisoner during wartime, while still in a state of being outlawed by deposition. So therefore, the loss of at Aughrim is quite serious.
Mm-hmm.
It means a significant loss in land ownership. And like, land ownership matters, because land ownership is political power. It's social, mm-hmm. it's social prestige. And if you look at the people who are killed or taken prisoner, look at the landowners. I have the list here in front of me. I mean, moving from the top down, you have Nicholas Brown, Viscount Kenmare, who had 46,000, over 46,000 acres. John Burke, Viscount Buffin, 32,000. Christopher Fleming, Baron's Lane, 12,000. John Bellew, Baron of Deleek, 9,193, and so on. Right, these people, what happens, if you just take the top four there, Kenmare, the Kenmare estate is quite exceptional in that they managed to keep their land and keep their religion. But more particularly, the Buffin, ultimately the Clan Rickard interest, which is enormously important in Galway. The Fleming interest in Slane, which is County Meath, the Bellew interest in Gilleaton in Louth, they keep their lands, but only at the cost of converting.
Mm.
But now that matters, because by converting, they are ultimately in the long run subsumed within the Anglo-Irish Protestant ascendancy interest. So you can see how what happens at Aughrim debilitates the landed Catholic interest, and thereby weakens its capacity to mount military resistance in the future, or certainly effective political resistance, or even give political or cultural leadership in the regions, in their own regions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we should say as well that in the 17th century, converting religion isn't just a matter of changing your church on Sunday, it's a matter of connecting yourself with a whole different culture and day-to-day life, isn't that right?
Thanks for that reminder. That is true. It's not a matter of you're converting or conforming to the established church. It means that you then have full civil and political rights. But by doing so, you are identifying with one community, one political establishment, one community. Even at this stage, when people talk about Irish and English, they mean Catholic and Protestant. William Ideside, the people who win, they would, even though they may have been settled in Ireland for generations at this stage, they still regard themselves as the Protestants of Ireland or the English or Scottish of Ireland. It's only later on that in the 18th century that they begin to think of themselves as Irish.
Mm-hmm.
So the equation of Catholic and Irish, there's a cultural, ethnic, linguistic, even linguistic, but certainly cultural and ethnic, as well as a religious dimension to this. So mm-hmm. When you're changing religion, as it were, you're changing an entire political identity, political loyalty, and I think historians tend to underestimate the importance of that change and what the costs involved. That it's not just something, a survival strategy that you can readily adopt. There is a psychic cost.
The other side of the battlefield at Aughrim and the point of view culturally from there, which is the Protestant interest, and Aughrim was originally the 12th, the first 12th, isn't that right?
Certainly on the Irish Protestant community. That was the battle, that was the 12th of July. That was the most popularly favoured annual marker and annual celebrations. And that changed towards the latter part of the 18th century. Two reasons. One, belatedly, England adopted the new calendar, as it were, that had been in use in Catholic countries for much longer, and some Protestant communities at this stage, which means that if you take the Battle of the Boyne, for example, that happens old style, as we call it, on the 1st of July, by the time England or Britain adopts the new time, that date has now become the 12th of July. So, paradoxically or coincidentally, the new date for the Battle of the Boyne is the 12th of July. So you've got a celebration that happens on the 12th of July, and you've got an event that hitherto happened the 1st of July, now is happening on the 12th of July. The two become subsumed, particularly with the growing cult of the Orange cult, the growing emphasis on William and King William or King Billy in the latter part of the 18th century. And that is, the fact is that King William was at the Boyne, he was at Aughrim. So you've got a greater glamour associated with the Boyne, in that you have two kings fighting for three kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And you've got the main players, as it were, still present.
But for 100 years, things like the bonfires, and I don't know if they had parades back then, because this is, of course, before the Orange Order, but there's certainly bonfires and there's prayer services and things in praise of the Battle of Aughrim, isn't that right?
That's right. They're popular celebrations, mainly bonfires, for 60 or 70 years, 80 years after that event. So the 12th is Aughrim. And then it slips from Protestant memory, and it has a renaissance in Irish nationalist or Catholic memory in the 19th century. From Tom Moore, let's say, down to the early 90s, when there's a revival of interest in Aughrim. And thereafter, in the 20th century, I think it falls into neglect. It's no longer considered as important. So events have fads or have periods when they're much recalled and then they're comparatively neglected. And Aughrim then fell into this kind of memory.